Hello, everyone, and welcome to That Millennial Life, a podcast where I talk to millennials about their lives and how they are managing young adulthood. How are you all doing? I hope you are enjoying whatever day you are listening to this on, whether it be April 18th, 2016, the day of which this podcast was released, or maybe you're listening to this in 2026. You know, that's the great thing about podcasts. You get to them when you get to them. But anyway, the day that I'm recording this is on April 16th, 2016, which is my birthday. And today I turned 23. And you know, I'm ambivalent. I don't think a 23rd birthday warrants that much of a celebration. But I'm going out with my friends later, so there will be some celebrating. But the only real feeling I had when I woke up this morning was, okay, you're 23. Let's start to get our shit together. But you know, I also am excited for this year, and I'm gonna try to get some of my shit together. I have some ideas of how to get this podcast in more people's ears. But yeah, 23. It is now. I want to get to the interview because the interview is quite long. You know, I talked to someone named Keith Brady, who I know as Mr. Brady. Calling him that is strange, and I address that in the interview because he was a teacher at the high school that I went to and still continues to be. He is the oldest guest I have had on, which I also tell him about in the interview, much to his chagrin. But I think it made for a much more unique conversation than any other one I've had previous, and that's really all I want to say because it's a long interview, and we cover a lot. I don't need to talk anymore. And when we cut into the beginning of the interview, he is commenting about some of the posters in my room, just for context. So anyway, here is my conversation with Mr. Keith Brady.
Can I comment about some of the other things?
Yes,
here?
Go ahead.
So clearly, great taste in your HBO programming.
Right.
Your AMC programming.
Right.
Which, Better Call Saul, oh wow.
Right. Have you been watching?
Absolutely.
Mm.
Haven't seen this week's episode.
Best of the season.
Really?
Oh my God.
That's heavy praise.
It had Breaking Bad essence.
Because I've been waiting for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's had its own charm to stand out and be apart from Breaking Bad.
Right.
Which is a show that I will...
It's definitely different. It's slower, but like not in a bad way.
No, and it still retains a lot of the Saul charm.
Yes.
While matriculating through this origin story that even mm-hmm. though... And this is what something I never liked about prequels, but they do a really good job. Like, you eventually know how it ends.
Yeah.
You eventually know how Better Call Saul...
Yep.
Well, Saul Goodman's story, you know how it ends. But I'm still intrigued about how he becomes this person that you instantly fall in love the first time he shows up in Breaking Bad.
It's about the journey, not the destination.
Oh, I should put that on a t-shirt. And then I love how, and I know this is probably silly to say, like the first episode now of every season, if we're going to get this little glimpse into what his life is like now,
they are gonna,
it's my favorite part.
Yeah,
it's my favorite part.
Black and white where you see him.
So, spoiler alert, I guess for people maybe haven't watched it. Like, I'm just waiting for the beginning of a season when I guess someone finds him at the Cinnabon.
I wonder if that's ever going to happen,
And just knocks him off.
Yeah.
And I keep telling my wife that, and I go,
get
ready for it.
Do you think it's just going to end with him?
I don't know, because that's what Vince Gilligan does.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's what made me hate Breaking Bad and love it at the same time.
Because he's a master of tension-induced anxiety attacks.
Yes, I hated it. There was a show that was on, I think it was on IFC, and it replayed on Netflix. It's called The Writer's Room.
Right.
And it was hosted by Jim Rash, who wrote the, oh my goodness, what was that Clooney movie where he's out in Hawaii and it has something to do with like finding like his family? I don't know.
Oh, The Descendants?
The Descendants.
So Alexander Payne.
I have no idea what that is.
He's the director of the movie.
Got it. Jim Rash, I think, wrote that script, won an Oscar award for the script.
I probably did.
I know Jim Rash because I used to love Community. And he's...
Right, right. I've just started watching Community.
He's the dean on Community.
Oh, really?
which, by the way,
I've gotten there yet.
We'll have to talk Community at a later date.
Yeah.
Tremendous.
Oh, my God.
So Jim Rash hosts this show where he brings in a lot of basically the writers
mm-hmm.
from these tremendous shows like Breaking Bad and Game of Thrones and Parks and Rec and others.
Right. It's like a round table kind
of. Yeah, and it's fascinating to just hear them talk about their creative process.
Right.
And if Vince Gilligan's to be believed, the entire Walter White story arc was planned out from the beginning.
Yes.
And it's evident in how tremendous it goes from start to finish through five seasons?
Five, yes.
And mm-hmm. everything that happens
makes
sense. There
was a 5A and a 5B.
Oh, they did one of those things? Like yeah. Mad Men did that?
Yeah, well, Mad Men did got it from Breaking Bad.
Oh,
it was all right, though.
I like that.
Yeah.
I never liked
it. Well, they wanted to separate it out because it was like 7 and 7 instead of making it a full 14. They just wanted it's for money, Mr.
Of course it is. But, of course it is.
Yeah. But yeah, he had that whole like Mr. Chips to Scarface is the way he described it. He wanted
perfect.
To take someone, he wanted to see the full transformation given someone with a specific set of circumstances. How could they completely just break bad? Can they go to that place?
And you root for him for
yeah.
a long time.
Well, yeah. And then it gets to a point. There's people who rooted for him the whole way, I think, but...
Can I share when I tapped out?
Yeah.
Again, spoiler alerts, everybody.
If you haven't seen Breaking Bad...
What's wrong with you? Be a human.
Yeah.
Mike Ehrmantraut.
Yeah.
When he puts one in Mike Ehrmantraut's gut, I'm done.
Yeah.
Screw you, Walter White.
Because you that was a thing where it was full ego.
Yes.
Just clouded his better judgment. He even said, I could have just gotten the names from Lydia. He didn't even need to do it. And it was just because he was being... defied.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
It's my moment.
Mm-hmm.
Plus Mike Ehrmantraut.
I agree with you.
He's this old man who's invincible,
mm-hmm.
and all he wants to do is provide for his grandchild.
The lily of the valley, too, the poisoning of...
It's a great illusion.
But part of me was like, he didn't kill him, though. But
don't
anyway.
Don't justify that.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm sitting with... See, this is the... this. I'm at a crossroads with this because I don't know how to introduce you because I feel odd calling you anything other than Mr. Brady.
It's okay. Mm-hmm. I say do it. Rip the Band-Aid off.
Okay. I'm sitting here with Keith Brady. Oh. Wow, that felt good.
It's cathartic, isn't it?
Yeah. He was a teacher. He still is.
Still is.
He was I was at Pequannock Township High School, he was a teacher there at the time and still is. And he was my lacrosse coach.
Oh, those hammies.
Yeah. Do you want to
okay,
share
sure,
that
because we had to talk about that.
Yeah, I wanted to.
So I don't know if it was my first year coaching lacrosse,
I think it was.
But it was just before every single game. I mean, Joe had tight hammies.
Yeah.
And
I had a back problem that they said was caused by bad hamstring flexibility. I have great, the doctor said, great groin flexibility.
Yeah.
I could put my foot behind my head.
Don't need to see it.
Okay.
I was close enough as it was back then.
There's pictures somewhere. But
is it like rule 46 of the internet or something like that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He said I had the hamstring flexibility of a 50-year-old. Bad,
yeah.
Bad stuff.
And we, in order to get you stretched for a game,
mm-hmm.
had to have someone physically
mm-hmm.
go down near where the hamstrings are whilst laying flat.
Push it back. I was lying on my back. You had to push my legs back like
yeah.
a slingshot.
Yeah. So at the wrong viewing angle, somebody would go, why is that public employee doing that to that child? We need to make a phone call.
And that was at a time where I was a much larger gentleman, so it must have been like pushing, I don't know.
Can I be honest, like ham hocks?
Yeah.
As someone who used to be a much larger gentleman myself, I feel
yeah.
like that's one of those things.
Oh my God.
It's like, I can make fun of that person because mm-hmm. I have a friend who's that. So mm-hmm. yeah, one of those kind of deals.
Yeah.
So it's been a long, interesting journey, and to be able to say the K word as it's known, you go for it.
Yeah, that was, wasn't that a thing that if students
yeah.
said you got really mad,
oh,
anyone
yeah.
try to cross that line?
Absolutely.
That's a no-no.
A huge no-no. I remember my first year teaching, one kid came up to me at an after-school event and purposely just did it, and he did it with that tone. He's like, how's it going, Keith?
Oh.
And just, you could feel it just draw off of his tongue.
Mm-hmm.
And you just knew, you're just doing this because you want to be that kid.
What was your response to that?
It was
death
calm,
stare?
Cool, and collected. Mm-hmm. Don't have to do that stare. It's just, Mr. So-and-so, you know that that is something that you shouldn't be saying. It's disrespectful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to ask you to stop doing that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Keith.
Did it again.
So to me, I'm a big believer in the long con. You know, you let everybody think that they're safe.
Yeah.
And then when you least expect it. So mm-hmm. I think I wrote them up like... It was a weekend
mm-hmm.
event, and I wrote him up midweek the
wow.
next week. And then he got some sort of attention or whatever we do in public school now.
Right.
And that was the end of that. And now mm-hmm. it's just this weird, strange lore. And it's fascinating because as I get older and you just watch what you can make teenagers believe is sacrosanct, it just kind of blows my mind. And it's this thing now. And people who've never even had me as a teacher, they hear this like some legendary little nugget of information.
We don't want to end up like that kid.
Correct.
Yeah. But I have to say, it's a group consensus among several people I've talked to that you are among the favorites, if not the favorite of teachers to ever be there during my time, which was inspired by that you came down to our level, you know? You never like tried to be above anyone.
No.
And you were able to, and you were of a younger,
absolutely. Yeah,
you were a little closer in age than to us than other teachers were. And kind of able to identify with you.
Not that this is a podcast about how to teach, but I was just a firm believer of teenagers want to be treated nothing more than adults because they want to be adults so badly, even though deep down they know that they need to be treated like kids. So you just found this middle ground where so long as you can come down and respect them on a level that you let them know that they're human beings, they have value as well.
Mm-hmm.
I found that using that approach kind of got me in with every kind of group. So, you know, the weird nerdy kids, which I was, so immediate connection, you know, the jocks, the popular kids, all of a sudden like the ne'er-do-wells. I connected with everybody because as long as you made them feel valued, they at least gave you some sort of respect in return.
I've never even heard that from a teacher, like identifying those different cliques and how...
Really?
Yeah. If there's like a different way to try to get in with them or interact with them. Because I'm sure it's different for like kid to kid, but like I guess in that sense, it's just treat them with respect.
It is, but it also helps that, again, I started off as a ridiculously nerdy kid, so I've got that cred with that group.
Mm-hmm.
I love sports, and I'm a sports fanatic. Mm-hmm. I've got that cred with certain jocks. Mm-hmm. I feel like as a male teacher, this sounds terrible, but I feel like it's kind of true. For the most part, you connect with a lot of the female students because they're too used to having like feminine energy with their feminine teachers. And now you bring a different energy in as a guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then so long as you every once in a while let the ne'er-do-wells know, hey, I know you exist. I'm just going to say hi.
Right.
Let you do your ne'er-do-well thing. You know, never then our paths shall cross.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of respect that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I guess that comes just from kind of coming across a lot of different sort of cross sections of people.
Right.
And understanding what makes everybody tick.
Right. I think I was one of those kids in high school, too.
The ne'er-do-well kid?
No.
Okay, good, because you weren't.
No, I was someone who was able to kind of... I was able to kind of go into any group. I was in choir. I was in the plays. I was in sports. Mm-hmm. I felt like I could talk to anyone, but at the same time, I may have not chosen to all the time.
Sure, right, exactly. But a seamless transition when you needed to go back to television, like a Dexter connoisseur. You could fit in with the normal people, you had your own little private moments on the side.
Yeah, but I've talked about that before. But anyway, I never had you as a teacher because I was too busy taking choir and TV and video production electives. But I was able to, you know, still... come through. And so I want to talk about how a week ago I watched Bacon, Egg, and Cheese. And I was just talking to Bobby. I saw him at the barber today. He's that movie. So someone commented on it recently on Facebook and it popped up again. And it got like people watched again. He's like, I can't get away from that role. So, do you want to tell the story of what the video was?
Yeah. All right. So quick little overview. It was I was teaching a personal finance course and I had the kids at the time, after learning a lot about how banks work, do a video project, or most chose to do a video project of, okay, I want you to make a bank and I want you to design different features and savings instruments and products that the bank might offer and just prove to me that you know kind of what you were talking about.
Right.
But then when you give kids the ability to do a video project, especially like, you know, 7-8 years ago when video projects were still really cool to do.
Are they not anymore?
I don't know. I hear kids talking about how video projects are no longer like worth doing. It's more trouble.
Right. But so lazy.
It's
so fun. It's such a better alternative.
Yes.
Thing to.
Yes. But it's laziness and you are the kind of type and a lot of the guys who did those kind of projects were the kind of type where that's fun because other things that are now fun for teenagers didn't maybe exist in such a short time period that we're removed from it. Mm. Also, the dynamic has changed socially. But all right, so
we're going to get into that later a little bit.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah,
teaser, everybody.
Yeah.
So the project that I want to make sure I get this right now. It's Mike Duffy.
Right.
Kev McMichael.
Yeah.
Kev Campo. I oftentimes call him by his brother's name, but yeah. It's Kev Campo.
And Joe Diffin.
And Joe Diffin.
Were the four in your class.
Yes.
They asked me to help.
Yes. They Bobby asked Weiss, Kev Devine to help and Bobby Devine. Weiss.
We shot it at Pete Stavala's house.
Wonderful little cameo roles. And Pete's car, I think, made a cameo.
Yes.
Yeah. So the whole premise of the video is instead of just making like a traditional bank and here's the things we do, they made this amazing, seamless Monty Python-esque, like, let's go from one skit to another, but they all tie together to talk about what this bank offers.
Yeah.
And it was just play on words. Instead of bacon, egg, and cheese, it's bankin' egg and cheese.
That was the name of the bank.
With a great title sequence, by the way, with pieces of like Kraft cheese, like single serve, stuck to a wall with the name of the bank written on it. And just all these wonderful little vignettes and skits, and yeah. Bobby's was the crowd pleaser.
Yes, he was a cross dresser.
Yeah, that might be the
man.
Sure,
woman.
Like he would have won RuPaul's Drag Race kind of thing.
Who wanted to start a bank account, but only he needs $10 to start a bank account, but he only had $9.57 in all nickels
and two pennies.
And then he walked past all the bankers who were checking him out, and McMichael goes, "It's a dude.
It's a dude."
And
then there's a spit take. There's a loud audible groan, and then underneath those two lines delivered is the so seldom heard, "Oh, not again," lament.
That was Campo, I think. There are some lines in there that still hold up.
They absolutely do.
Yeah.
And there's a skit, one of the skits, and I've said this every single year since I've shown it, that
you
doesn't
show it,
get enough.
Right,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And there's kids now who know about it who have no connection
to us.
Any of them.
Yeah.
By the way, the Jordan Loan joke. Absolutely.
Savings loans.
Correct.
There's Jordan. A kid named Jordan Loan. So we said that as a name of a loan.
Kid's last name is spelled LOHN. And they got a picture of him like on Facebook or stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, it's just a quick edit. The Jordan Loan, there's a picture of him. It zooms in slowly. And it's like some holiday picture or something. Yeah. He's got this kind of smile on his face. And then Joe looking at the camera with this just bewildered look, just completely removes you from the universe that's in.
And then it cuts back to the storyline, like as if it never happened.
Yes. The one skit I liked, sorry if we're spending too much time on this,
but it's worthy
of doing.
Yeah.
The Mike Duffy.
Right.
I'm going to explain what we do at our bank.
Right.
While I intersperse it with the details of how I just had a workplace incident fueled by anger and rage. And while I'm doing this, slowly unbuttoning my tie and my collar as if I can't handle this anymore.
Taking his tie up.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Often underappreciated. Mm,
great. But those are the type of things that you and people like Mr. Perez and other teachers, obviously Mr. Simonetti, because that's what the class was, let us do. And really, because, I mean, as much as there was, or the creative side of school was... we were able to do that type of stuff. I don't think it was enough. So like to have that as an outlet too, as a rare thing to just be able to, you know, have some fun. And
yes, it can't be business all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be able to do something where you can have a little bit of fun with yourself
in
order to still kind of learn. Sorry to make it cheesy now at the end, but it's true.
But anyway, so first I want to establish, if you don't mind me saying, you are the oldest guest I have had.
Oh my God.
Because this is a show about millennials.
Yeah.
People usually in their 20s, but I've come
Not
to realize
this guy.
I've come to realize that millennials usually fall under the umbrella of being born from 1980 to 2000.
Correct.
And you fall under that.
I do.
When
should we reveal?
Do you mind?
Cuz this is another one of those like K-word like items of lore.
Can we?
Yeah, ready? Here we go. Get your when was Mr. Brady born pool tickets out. if you guessed 1983, you win.
Wow.
So I'm 33
as of this
recording. Yes.
That is interesting.
April 1st.
Because some people use the parameter some people say millennials fall under 1982 to 2000.
Ooh.
So I was like, should we do it? But 1983, you're right at the beginning.
I just snuck in under the wire.
To be honest, I'm like interested to have a millennial from that time because a lot of the people were, you know, late 1990s or the early 1990s, late 1980s.
Sure.
Which I think is what like in pop culture, millennials are usually associated with around that time.
Yeah, 90s especially.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
But so one thing I was interested in was, are there any generalizations about millennials closer to your age that you know of? Or because you came right after Generation X, does it usually fall into that? Do you consider yourself a millennial? Do you fit that mold? Do you think?
I don't consider myself a millennial.
Right.
And the reason I think I don't is not so much that I feel like myself and other like early 30-somethings
right.
are more closely characterized the same way you would characterize like the 40-somethings in the Generation X.
Right.
But, and I can't prove this because clearly not a sociologist.
Right.
But I feel like the advent of widely available internet
right.
is the line of demarcation that separates me and my older millennial group from the newer or at least younger millennial group. Like, I didn't have internet in my household until I was 16, 17. I was like a junior.
So you think you need to be earlier on in your adolescence at the boom of the internet
absolutely.
In order to be considered. You need to kind of be grown up. Because I remember internet starting to use it more thoroughly when I was like 11, 10. So yeah, I guess that makes sense.
And you had at that point dial-up internet, yes or no?
Yeah.
You did.
To start out.
Okay. So you'd have
to... Or maybe before that we did.
You know, connect to the internet.
Phone, if your phone
makes the robot noise.
Yeah. You can't talk on the phone and be on the internet at the same time.
Yes. And then all of a sudden, now you have a generation that in their formative years, I mean, call it, let's say 12 through 15, 16, they have internet readily accessible, whether it's on a computer or on their phone. And to me, the internet is the greatest... I don't know if you would call it an invention or a discovery. I mean, to me, like fire, discovery, electricity, discovery, internet, I don't know.
Yeah.
Because to me, it's the totality of human consciousness in one accessible, you can't even call it a location even, but it's there. And then it's at everyone's fingertips in the years when their brain is starting to create the kind of person that they are. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like, you know, for a terrible analogy, like you've got this link to the Matrix at right. such a young age. Like you know everything if you want to know it. And younger people now are just so more knowledgeable, so more worldly, so more tolerant, more athletically gifted. Like all these things that took...
Why do you think that?
Because I think that when they want to know...
Something.
It's there. Mm-hmm. And they have it. As opposed to if I wanted to know something, I had to struggle, try to find it at the library, number one. And then number two, because I was a teenager, that took too much effort and I'm clearly not going to do that.
Right.
So I'm just going to continue doing what I'm already doing and never really try and strive to improve that much or change that much or be something different than the norm, as everybody else kind of was to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what has changed and separated my older millennial generation from the rest, because we just didn't develop the same way at all, because we didn't have that one amazing resource available to us as readily available as everyone else did.
Do you think there's some bitterness because they weren't at like the apex of it? There isn't any clear identifiable group that they're associated with, because they're too young to be Generation X, but they're too old to, they don't have a generational identity. It is vague, but
yes,
I don't even know that many young people who exist and operate through their lives with the notion of that they're in like a part of a specific generation that kind of defines them. But I don't know, because generation dynamics is something that I'm just kind of getting more, obviously because of the show, kind of investigating more.
Again, not a sociologist, but I feel like just the lines just continually get blurred as the generations pass.
I think
there was clear line of demarcation when you had like that immigrant group come over, which gave rise to, you know, the greatest generation, the one that fought the wars and went through the Depression. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden now you could see that the mistakes made by that set of parents gives rise to the baby boomers, and they had a little bit less of a defined identity, and it certainly wasn't as close to their parents' identity. And then they give rise to Generation X, which kind of latched on to a little bit of that. But at the same time, Generation X was kind of broader than the baby boomers were. And now I agree, like there's no definitive set of characteristics. There's no like starter kit for millennials that you could kind of pick up and all of a sudden say, this is what these kids are, this is what these young adults are, this is what these 20-somethings are. And I just feel like everything is just kind of becoming a little more culturally, I don't want to use the term homogenous because I don't think that's the word, but it just, it's not as clearly defined. And I could see that continuing to happen. And globalization, I think, has a big part of that too, because now, you know, borders are something on a map necessarily anymore, depending on the kind of countries that you're talking about. But it is interesting to kind
of
note that.
And depending on the kind of politicians you're talking about.
Why are we going to do this now?
No. Okay, I don't want to talk about that.
I don't want to do that either.
Neither do I.
I just can't. It just makes me angry. Yeah. I can't watch any of this.
Yeah.
I can't. So, yeah, we can skip that.
Okay. But, yeah, I love what you're saying about, the whole generation dynamics. And I think the reason why people identify those is because people like to, and I like to have, and kind of started taking a liking to this, kind of study how each generation was affected by the previous or has affected the one after them, the one preceding them. And I think when you talk about that, a lot of that has to do with family dynamics and parentage. And with millennials, you know, there's a trope that the parents of millennials are very active. You know, the parents are in their lives and care very much about them, and that's where the whole everybody gets a trophy thing comes from, because everyone needs to be accounted for.
Absolutely.
I think the reason for that is because, you know, our parents, or a lot of people in their 20s, a lot of millennials, their parents were either, you know, at the beginning of Generation X or at the tail end of the baby boomers, and their parents were in the silent generation. You know, that's the whole Mad Men era, right?
Yes.
The people who, they got that name because they were a little withdrawn and a little disassociated. They were, you know, all this like post-World War II boom.
Yes.
That the baby boomers were born into, but silent generation kind of
lived through
and kind of became adults through. And it was, you know, there was all this excess in the world and this post-World War II nationalism, and everything was supposed to be great, but everyone was like, I don't feel great.
No.
Right? There was this kind of conservatism. There is this traditional, like, that's where the silence comes from, because they were, like, told to be quiet their whole life, right? And behave. But since they were a little disassociated, they, in turn, had kids who didn't want to fit that mold, right? And that's where the whole counterculture came from. That's where like Kerouac and all that crazy, the Beats and all that stuff came from. So that's why I think our parents, they had parents who were kind of not engaged.
Yeah, it's very interesting that you note that, because I would say the same. You have to go back a generation to see why the generation after it became who they were.
Right.
And they did one of two things. Either they totally rebelled or they somewhat conformed.
Right.
And I know that almost sounds like an obvious diametrically opposed choice, but I don't know if there's ever going to be a definitive middle ground where maybe millennials are the first ones where they're going to take some good aspects of the parents that raised them and then also make their own way, because, and I'm sorry to get caught on the subject, but they're so much more well-informed that they can start to delineate and pick and choose, okay, well, mom and dad did this and this was good, and maybe I can kind of do that for the generation that comes after me. And
you always want to take the good and leave the bad.
Yeah, you kind of do.
Yeah.
But I feel like...
But it's part of you there somewhere, though, still.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
But go way, way back, like you were saying, that silent generation, they kept that whole idea of keep it to yourself, you know, push your feelings deep down inside, you know, like why Don Draper has to go back to his office all the time whenever he can't handle something in public kind of deal, and just drink it all away.
Yeah.
That kind of feeling.
He's looking for something, but like he's looking for some type of happiness, but everyone expects that it's just there kind of thing.
And then the generation after that had no problem expressing that happiness, maybe almost too much out in the open in front of everybody. Mm-hmm. And then Generation X had that generation, that hippie baby boomer generation kind of raised them and just pushed those ideals on top of them.
And it wasn't, I think we were talking about, it was like everyone coming together, and it was like that back then a little bit, because I think everyone kind of associates the baby boomers with like leading this counterculture and this new way of doing things, but they were more the supporters and the mass of it, where the silent generation was like the people who were who were the leaders of it.
Oh yeah.
And it was the people before him. What was it? Was it the greatest generation?
I think, technically,
GI generation.
Yeah.
They were the ones who kind of were like, didn't like what was going on in like the, what are these young kids doing? But like the Chicago.
These kids and their jazz.
But like the Beatles and like George Carlin and the Chicago 7.
Yes.
They were all silent generation. So they were a part of it. It was just the baby boomers who were like, kind of were a part of the group, are kind of the supporters of the few silent generation who tried to break the mold. But yeah, so the reason I'm talking about this is because my parents were very much like that. My mom was very, oh, anything you want, you know, genuine, but not nearly as smothering as some of other parents I've seen of people my age. And I got a good mix of my dad, even though he was very kind and gave me so many opportunities and privilege that he never had. He still was like, he's still stoic. He's still, you know.
He plays the dad role.
Right.
Yeah.
But I was wondering if you being kind of in this middle of the road between generations, what your parents were like, were they full on baby boomers? Were they right in the middle, or were they at the beginning of that?
So my dad was born in 47.
Right.
So he might not even be in the
mid-40s was the beginning of the baby boomers.
Yeah. And my mom was born in 52.
Right.
I don't know. I might be a case that you can't make that generalization about, because I grew up in a two-family little apartment building in the Bronx.
Right.
And me, my sister, and my parents lived upstairs. My grandmother, from Ireland, off the boat, born 1918, lived downstairs. And my grandmother honestly did a great amount of the child rearing for me and my sister. But, you know, as Irish Catholics, that totally rolled downhill to my parents, who they supported me when I needed support, but they definitely were not helicopter parents.
Right.
They were not wiping my backside every single minute of the day.
Right.
You know, I don't know if this is even something to talk about, but just to give you an idea, like, I got the belt and I deserved the belt.
Yeah.
And my family was the wait till your dad gets home kind of family.
Oh, God.
And we lived in the upstairs, as I pretty much mentioned, and the stairs were made of wood.
Right.
And I mean, you can't write. It's almost like an Everybody Loves Chris kind of moment. Like, your dad comes home and you hear creak, 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 and your blood pressure. Yeah. And you're in this little tiny apartment. Like, there's nowhere else to hide.
Wow,
I don't know how many places I can hide that he already hasn't found me, because I know I'm going to get the belt kind of thing. Because my parents always took the side of the teachers and everybody in authority. And they got that from my grandmother, who came over from Ireland, had to deal with things over in Ireland that were really not that great at the time. And we made something from that, and there wasn't going to be all of this hand-holding.
Did you ever have to reckon with that later in life? Did you have to, like, was there ever a... I feel like there's a great Marc Maron quote where he says, every father-son relationship is a battle to the death.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, no, we've had those moments.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
My dad and I, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
In my 20s, I hated my father.
Mm.
And there were a couple times where, and I know this is not appropriate to kind of have as a father-son relationship, like it got physical, because it's all of a sudden now it's two alpha males, especially the young pup alpha male who wants to kind of prove his worth to dad and stand up to dad, because dad spent most of his formative years, meaning me, always being the authoritarian. Well, I totally tripped over that one. And always being the executioner who kind of lowered the sword
all the
time.
Where do you think that came from, wanting to do that? It was just the way...
Oh, from the nuns.
Yeah.
Like, what an out-of-left-field answer, I'm sure, but from the nuns. Mm. Because when my dad was in Catholic school, the nuns used to beat the living daylights out of him all the time.
And he thought it worked?
Yeah. And I gotta be honest, it did.
Mm-hmm.
It really did.
Mm-hmm.
I turned out great. My sister turned out great. And not that I'm saying that I would turn around and
do
take
that.
The belt to my kids, but it totally put me in line, because I am my father's son. I pulled shenanigans like my father pulled, not to that extent, because I also have my mom's genes and she was a little bit more demure.
Mm-hmm.
But my dad put me in my place as a young kid, because young kids sometimes need to get put in their place.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't always have to be through violence. That was the choice my parents made.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't like my dad for the longest time.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I finally had a job, had responsibilities, and realized what a struggle it is to try and just make a living for yourself and a family, all of a sudden I did a complete 180. And I hated myself for hating my dad.
Right.
Like, you little brat.
Yeah.
Your father, when he took your family out of the Bronx and moved you to idyllic Sussex County because the neighborhood was turning sour, and then on a daily basis drove back into the Bronx to work on construction, buildings, air ducts, and heating systems.
Right.
And then at some point realized, I can't keep making this drive, would live in a tiny room smaller than this room in an apartment in Brooklyn 5 days a week and then come back to visit us on the weekends. And who am I to ever have turned around to my father and told him anything other than, I love you.
Right.
Thank you for everything you did to sacrifice for this family. Because as an adult now, I don't make nearly enough sacrifices that my father made.
Yeah.
And it's still this hard.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what it was like for my
dad. Because
when
you're a kid, you don't understand the sacrifices that you're making.
Absolutely.
Sometimes my dad gets stressed or he's like angry about something. I'm like, why are you that angry? And it's like, oh, you have all of these responsibilities. You have so
I forgot about that.
You have so much more to be worrying about than I do.
Yeah, I just have to make sure I wake up by noon tomorrow.
Yeah. But, oh, you have a house that you have to worry if it's good or not. Like, you have a yard, you have a kid, you have two kids.
Mortgage? I don't know. What
mortgage,
is that?
Yeah, God. But, yeah, that's interesting.
So I think I'm a rare case.
Yeah.
But I can see that in my friends' families.
Right.
Where that dynamic absolutely existed. But their upbringing was different. You know, they either lived in suburbia their entire lives or... their family might have been, second or third generation American, where my family was first generation because my dad and my mom were the first ones born in this country in our family. And I think a lot of those ideals came over with my grandparents, you know, one set from Ireland, one set from Italy, both Catholic either way. So it's guilt on either sides. And that kind of thing was a big part of my formative years and even into my early 20s. Mm. So I might be a little bit different in that regard.
What was the Bronx like in the 80s?
The Bronx in the 80s was awesome. Not quite Bronx Tale-esque, but pretty darn cool.
Yeah.
So I have to always tell this story. So I almost got shot. what a great way to jump into this. So... we lived, like I said, the two-family house, and my dad and my grandfather, who died before I was born, built this extension on the upper level of the house to kind of act as like a small family room, dining room scenario. And that room overlooked a street that was on a hill. So I'm sitting next to the window, kind of like we're sitting here right now, or the windows are directly next to our faces. And I'm sitting there, and I'm eating macaroni and cheese, distinctly remembered. And all of a sudden, we hear a pop from down the street, and the glass right next to me breaks.
Wow.
Right by my face. So the only thing that kept me from taking one to the dome, as it were, was that we had no heat in the house. And my dad used to put plexiglass on the windows to hold in the heat and insulation. And there was this huge cone-shaped mark where the bullet had kind of came through and protruded the glass
but
without
didn't
breaking,
make its way through.
But didn't make its way through, and then just dropped onto the shelf next to me.
How dare you ever be mad at your dad?
Exactly. He worked a job and he saved your life. You would have had one right through your skull. Yeah. And the Bronx was fun because every day you're 8, 9, 10, 11, and what do you do when you get home? You change out of your Catholic school uniform and you just roam the streets like a street urchin. Yeah. And it was amazing. We would just go through alleyways and
a lot
play.
Of stickball.
Okay. I just got that question the other day when someone asked, no, we didn't play stickball. We played wall ball.
Mm-hmm.
We used to call it butts up.
That's what we called it.
Okay.
Because if you didn't make it, they threw a ball at your rear end.
Thank you.
To go against the wall.
Here's the kind of masochists we were coming from Irish Catholic families of guilt.
Yeah.
If you lost multiple times in a row, your punishment was not getting one in the backside. Your punishment was called sunny side up, and you had to turn around and face everybody,
that
put
occurred.
Your hands behind your back. Okay, good. So we're not the only crazy kind of sadomasochists.
But everyone would always put their hands forward. Oh, you cheated. Yeah. No, I didn't. I wouldn't have hidden it anyway.
Oh, Johnny Basile can't play with us anymore.
Yeah.
And it was awesome, and you'd stay out. Like, the cliche term is, you know, you got to come home when the streetlights come on.
Right.
And that's exactly how it was.
Wow.
And we would just roam
for
blocks.
So your parents just let you go?
They just let
that's
you go.
So not a millennial parent.
I know.
Thing.
And it wasn't like there wasn't danger because everyone's front door had the steel bars on the front door, and everyone locked their front doors, mm-hmm. but you knew that your kids weren't really going to get into that much trouble, mm-hmm. and the random kid that happened to get abducted is still like one in a couple of thousand. That sounds terrible.
Some Mystic River thing.
Yeah.
That was Boston, though. Not
it's a great movie, by the way.
Oh, my God.
And it was a blast. And then my parents, again, for the benefit of me and my sister, uprooted us out of that environment and took us to Sussex County.
Right.
Where I never thought it could be that dark, that quiet, and that just boring.
More a little rural.
Extremely rural. Mm-hmm. Like as a senior driving to high school, I would get stuck behind tractor trailers
when
and
was
be
that
late
move?
For school. That move was 94, I think.
So
I was 11, 12 years old around that time. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're starting at a new middle school, which that's a great time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
New kids sitting in the back.
Yeah.
And, you know, that also caused a lot of different changes, too. You know, we talked about being gentlemen of former heavier stature.
Yeah.
You know, you're outside, you're running around all the time, you're mm-hmm. exercising. And then when you move to Sussex and your friends live miles away, you got nothing better to do than just sit in your room, play Super Nintendo.
Yeah.
Just eat Cheez-Its or something.
Oh, that was
like that.
The rise of Super Nintendo.
That was it. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So you did high school in Sussex County.
Yeah.
If you could get back to the headspace of yourself right before college, you know, junior, senior year of high school you, and what you expected college to be for you or what you wanted out of it, and kind of like who you were then and how going through the college experience
yeah.
made you different coming out of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, absolutely. College was... the largest, okay, maybe not the largest, but absolutely the first major transformation of who I was as a person. So at first, I didn't even want to go away to college.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to stay home.
Right.
And then once we started looking at schools,
why was that?
Probably because even though, and I know I've kind of painted my family as just this.
Yeah.
Like every day in the Brady household is like Tel Aviv. Like yeah. you're just going to watch out. You never know where it's coming from kind of thing. My family, I mean, honestly, my mom and dad were wonderful. And mm-hmm. I just kind of liked the way things were. And mm-hmm. I just figured that college, everything's going to change. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be away from my family who I really do like. And I don't want to do that. But then eventually you realize you're going to have to suck it up and get it over it and mm-hmm. go away to college. So go away to college, and you know, I go to the University of Scranton, and it's like an hour and a half away, so mm-hmm. far enough away to be away, but close enough that you can kind of come home.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately, and maybe this is where, to go back to one of the things we previously talked about, immediately I found myself connecting with so many different social groups that mm-hmm. I never thought I would connect with.
Because the blank slate, you could just be like,
you
do I like
fresh.
This? Do I like that?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Like the very first day, there's this huge hulking brute of a man child just throwing a lacrosse ball against the wall of the dorm next to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what possessed me to say hello to this person, mm-hmm. but I did.
Mm-hmm.
And he said hello to me and asked what my name was. And immediately I went, oh, so not every jock hates me. This is great. And then I roomed with a guy who went to DePaul, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is local for where we are right now, and played soccer and loved Metallica.
Mm.
And I loved Metallica, so we bonded over that, played some video games.
Yeah.
And then he introduced me to all these other social webs of just either popular people mm-hmm. or athletes or the nerdy kids who stayed back in the dorm. That was my natural habitat, so I could do that too. And that seamlessness started where now all of a sudden I'm comfortable being social, mm-hmm. which that didn't happen in high school. High school, I was very kept to myself, did my own thing, had my very small circle of friends, maybe five or six deep, and that was about it. And now all of a sudden, everything becomes different. And then, not to throw this in there, but it was a big part of my collegiate experience, I graduated high school May of 2001. I start college in August of 2001. I'm not even in college for a month, and September 11th.
Wow, I was in third grade then.
Yeah, and that was intense. I remember another reason I love college so much, like,
oh, that's got to be crazy as a 17-year-old, right when you're starting to get a more broad view of the world.
And just as I was getting comfortable with my world changing from I'm with my family every day to being, okay, I'm away from my family every day.
Everywhere else, the world is evil.
Yeah. And then not only that, I need to contact my family that day because my father works in Manhattan on a daily basis and I have family in Manhattan. And I was actually supposed to go into Manhattan for a funeral that day. Mm-hmm. It just makes it so much worse.
Wow.
And then you can't get a hold of anybody because all the phone lines are jammed up. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even know what was going on. I remember leaving my dorm room and I'm walking to class and my class was racquetball. Go college. That's a class and you earn credit for it. And there's no one on campus.
Yeah.
And I just hear a passing conversation where someone goes, the White House is on fire.
What?
And I have no idea what that is. And we get to class and it's me and maybe three other people.
Didn't in know a what class the White House was.
Yeah. White House is some magical thing that I've never heard of. Yeah. And we get to class. There's like five of the 12 kids that are supposed to be there. And
right.
our teacher, it's racquetball, so I don't know how that works. Comes up and just goes, yeah, he goes, you need to go back to your rooms.
Right.
And then I knew something was up.
Because it happened real early in the morning.
Real early in the morning, like maybe 8, 9 o'clock kind of thing, mm-hmm. 9, 10 o'clock maybe. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, I get back to my dorm, everyone's door is open, and I walk into my door, and what am I looking at on the screen but one of the Twin Towers basically on fire. Mm-hmm. And then as we're watching it live, the other plane hits the second tower.
You
and
saw
yes,
that.
On television, but yes, mm-hmm. saw it happen live on television. And it's just freak out time. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, we'll fast forward through the day. I eventually find out my family's thankfully safe, although my dad was in the World Trade Center Plaza earlier that morning.
Oh,
weird.
My God.
And I went home that night. My parents came up to Scranton. They got me, brought me home because I couldn't be there.
Right.
I think it was a Thursday that this happened. So, you know, classes were canceled for that day and the next day on Friday. And I remember I'm in my bed. You know, I was just there a couple of months ago mm-hmm. as a high school graduate. My life was going to change. And then all of a sudden you throw me back there. Mm-hmm. And everything that I kind of learned and developed in that 4-week stretch, because it's undone. And I remember leaving the television on and watching the news coverage, and they had this shot from New Jersey, and it's looking across the Hudson, and you can see the New York skyline, and there's just, again, smoldering ashes billowing out. Mm-hmm. And I just remember thinking, how is the world going to continue?
Yeah.
By the way, such an American myopic way of thinking, but I'm 18. This is everything. And that totally just grounded me immediately mm-hmm. where everything now is all of a sudden so fragile and we're not so safe and idyllic as possible. So you kind of have to make the most out of everything you got on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. So then going back to Scranton, it was, all right, guess what? Time to change. Mm-hmm. And started exercising a lot and working out and making sure I talked to everybody who I could talk to mm-hmm. and just branching out and doing things I never did and going to parties, mm-hmm. which I never did in high school. And it just immediately, that's the first step of transformation. So the thing that I was afraid of, this college, mm-hmm. this big boogie monster, all of a sudden was the greatest time of my life.
Right.
And I wish if there was a time machine, I would go back. And even if it meant reliving, this sounds terrible, that event, that initial shock, mm-hmm. that September, I would do it again in a heartbeat. And college was a time.
It's like a launching pad.
It really was.
It's so funny. I've heard a lot of other people on podcasts talk about that time and where they were at that time. And it's so funny how many, I'm not saying this in a bad way, but it's so funny how many people made that about themselves.
Oh,
you know what I'm saying?
I know what you mean.
Because like, it is like such a trend, an example is like a comedian being like, I was supposed to perform in New York today. Like, and being like completely disassociating from the fact that thousands of people died. Like,
yes.
How it's ruining your own life.
Yes.
But you took it a positive way. It was you transformed, you know.
Oh, absolutely had to. Mm-hmm. Especially because immediately my mind goes to, you know, we're a New York family.
Mm-hmm.
I could have easily lost
so many
family members, mm-hmm. much less one family member, mm-hmm. which unfortunately many people in this area right now, that's what they went through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have several families in this area that did lose family members mm-hmm. on that day. And it was that early moment of mortality, mm-hmm. You know, to get that at age 18, to really snap you back to understanding what's important.
Right.
And don't get me wrong, I had a lot of fun in college and I loved college,
mm-hmm.
but college definitely was not the 4-year party because that's what you think you're entitled to do. or some kids go through colleges. That's what they think they're entitled to do. Mm. Party time. The world outside of college doesn't exist. I'll deal with the real world once I graduate. No, the real world smacked me in the face 4 weeks into college. And right. that all of a sudden changed the way I approached college.
Was there a, right after that, within the college community, was there like a noticeable, well, you didn't have much of a knowledge of what the environment was like before that, but sure. was there a noticeable kind of lull?
Honestly, no. And the only reason I say that is because I felt like coming back to campus and other kids who came back to campus, we couldn't wait to come back to that safe haven mm-hmm. again. So even though I did have a different perspective on what I was going
to
do here, it was still
make everything seem like it just didn't happen.
Absolutely. So we couldn't wait to just go right back into mm-hmm. the routine of it was great to go to class, it was great to go party, it was great mm-hmm. to see my friends, go to the cafeteria and throw food mm-hmm. at each other because we could, mm-hmm. you know, because you're 19 and you're stupid. yeah. And that was comforting.
Yeah.
But it was just, you know, those little moments of fun, those little pockets of being a college kid, they were happy and they were fun to have. But it was the overall macro view of what am I really here to do that immediately I was aligned right. on a different path, you know, right away from freshman year, from that experience.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful for it. I'm extremely grateful for it because it instilled a work ethic in me where I kind of now understand as an adult how to be able to do both, how to be mm-hmm. responsible and how to have a great time for myself. Mm-hmm. And I'm very grateful for that. You know, I can work a job, I'm yeah. a public employee, yeah. and I don't really make a lot of money, but I have a comfortable life for myself because I learned a certain responsibility at an age when other kids kind of don't know that responsibility is something more than a six-syllable word. I had to count it. It was really sad. yeah, exactly.
So you're finished with college, yeah. right? What were the 20s like? What got you to education? What was yeah. your initial thought process coming out of college?
Sure.
In terms of, okay, so what now?
Right, yeah. Oh, life.
Because that's what I'm at and a lot of people who listen to this are at.
Oh, man. I'm going to sound like the worst kind of person then.
Why?
Okay, ready? So when I was in high school, I knew exactly what I wanted to do.
Right.
When I was in high school, I loved accounting. Mm-hmm. I'm like, numbers are great and this is rules and structure and no one's going to ever hurt me here.
Right.
And I also loved, I came from a big police and firefighter family. Mm-hmm. My dad wasn't, but it seemed like a lot of my uncles and cousins came from families where that was.
Right.
So I became enraptured with the idea of forensic accounting. The idea that, like, I could learn enough about accounting to just go and bust the bad guys by looking at their books and records.
Yeah.
And
Abagnale.
Yes, exactly. Another fantastic film. And the idea of I could be an accountant with a gun was immediately appealing.
Yeah.
And so I went to school knowing I was going to study accounting.
Yeah.
And I was a criminal justice minor. Mm. And as soon as I graduated, I started applying to several different government agencies because they all needed forensic accountants.
Like
all,
the CIA? Or?
So CIA, no. But IRS... Mm. Okay, this is where it gets really weird. So IRS, the Postal Service, because they have postal inspectors who they do hire with accounting backgrounds, and then they carry guns and have badges.
Wow.
Yeah, the oldest, if I'm not mistaken, the oldest federal law enforcement agency in our country are the postal inspectors.
I think I've heard that.
They've been around ever since, you know, the days of yore with cowboys and right. outlaws. And I remember being told a story, and I don't want to get off topic, but I don't know if anybody else knows this, and I always love this story. Mm-hmm. So the legend has it when, like, outlaw Jesse James would go into a building that was both the bank and the post office.
Right.
He would walk in with a piece of chalk and draw a line down the middle of the building.
Right.
And tell his gang, all right, on the left is the bank, on the right is the post office. Don't you dare set foot on the right of this building because that's postal inspector jurisdiction and they're going to come get us because they were a well-respected federal law enforcement agency. Mm-hmm. So, like, that immediately appealed to me.
Right.
And I applied to a couple of other agencies. I applied to the Fish and Wildlife Commission because they apparently needed a forensic accountant. Go figure. Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, the government code for special agent, well, I think it was like 1811. So, yeah. You know, all these different agencies needed
it. Was it the Fish and Wildlife what?
Commission?
Donald Trump's definitely trying to get rid of that.
We can't have them Mexicans ruining our state parks.
Yeah, oh God.
I'm just playing a Donald Trump character. Yes. Please don't think I'm someone listening to this is gonna look me up because I'm easy to find, public employee, and all of a sudden my career is down the tube.
Yeah.
And I got a job with the IRS right out of school, mm-hmm. and I went and I interviewed at the federal building for the IRS in New York City, mm-hmm. and they gave me a job as a special agent, and they were supposed to keep me in Fairfield.
Right.
And that was great. I wanted to stay in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And then I get a phone call a couple weeks after the job acceptance saying, no, we need you to go to Norwalk, Connecticut.
I know exactly where that is. That was close to where I went to school.
Okay, so
terrible area.
Thank you. I've described Norwalk as the Atlantic City of Connecticut, where you have the aquarium and like the immediate surrounding block, and it's nice. Mm. And then two blocks out is like Escape from New York.
Yeah, like, my God.
Just, you don't want to be caught out there.
It just looked gray,
too. Yeah, it's post-apocalyptic.
Yeah.
It's kind of sad. But, and I wanted no part of that. Uh-huh. And shame on me, you know, I should have been a little more industrious to go, yeah, well, you know, you're just starting out in a career, go do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't. So I turned the job down, and I knew immediately I needed to work because that's just what my family did. We just worked.
Right.
You know, so I was still living at home, and I was able to find a job working as a tax accountant for a company that was about an hour and a half away from where my parents' house was. Mm-hmm. So for 6 months, I drove there and back, hour and a half every single day, and I was Peter Gibbons.
Yeah.
And it was just office space, sit in the gray cubicle, there's no windows anywhere kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I hated it. I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I was good at the job. I was good at doing taxes, but I hated the work environment. And I don't know what it was, but all of a sudden I had like a wild hair up my backside. Well, what about teaching? Mm-hmm. I mean, you tutored people in college and they all said you were pretty good. You were a substitute on winter breaks at the middle school. So, you know, you've been there before. Mm-hmm. Why don't you just try it? So I said, yeah, that's easy. You know, I'll just do what every teacher of mine did and read out of the book and the kids are going to love it because I was that kid that could just go and have information thrown at me, and it was amazing because it was learning.
Yeah,
I thought every kid was like me. I was so wrong.
Were you good at retaining information audibly?
Just yes.
Sadly, is so not me. I went to get tested for ADD, and I found out I had a verbal-based learning inconsistency, whereas like, I'm so kind of much in my own head that whenever someone's talking to me, I have to really focus on what they're saying. And that was a big reason as to why I wanted to do this, because I wanted to become a better listener.
Yeah.
And I wanted to make sure that I could actually connect with people. So I have a difficult time. The way they tested is they would tell me like a minute story. Okay. And then I would have to tell them directly after everything I remembered from the story. And I couldn't remember anything.
That's a scientific test?
That's what they said.
That's awful.
Yeah. Well, with a bunch of other stuff they did too.
Got it.
But that was a part of the ADD thing. But anyway.
But then, okay, quick question then. Yeah. And I don't want to... So you're very musically inclined.
Right. That isn't words, though. Verbal, okay. Not audio.
So here's where I'm a dummy then.
Right.
What is the difference in terms of how one's brain processes words versus music and notes?
Different part of the brain.
Yeah, I don't know enough about that.
Neither do I.
Mine hurts right now just thinking about that.
Yeah. I'm
such a dummy sometimes.
Yeah.
Like everybody's like, oh my God, you're
definitely
so smart.
You know, different internalizing and comprehending what it means. It's got to be. But...
I guess that makes sense because I'm sure you have discussions about, you know, as we start to learn more about people with autism the certain kind of qualities that they can use and latch on to more quickly and others don't develop as well. So mm-hmm. I'm not saying you have autism, I'm just saying.
I think I may have had a hint of the Bergs.
Yeah, the Bergs. Just colloquially throwing that out there.
I heard someone say that on a podcast.
See, to me, I've heard on the spectrum.
Yeah.
You know, so you fall somewhere.
I've done an online test of that before.
And how'd that work out? Sounds very scientific.
I was like...
Did you find out you had cancer at the end? like every medical search? Yes.
I was at the... there was like a meter, and I was at the lowest end of the meter of you probably don't have autism.
Okay. Probably is good enough.
Yeah.
We'll go with that.
There was like a definitely don't, probably don't, and do, and I was at the tail end of the probably don't.
It's like a Likert scale for autism. Yeah. Like, wait, how old were you when you took that test?
Because... Last week. No, I'm not even joking. I took it last week because I've always been curious.
Did you take
because it? I have a very I forget what the word they use is when you have a very you have a you have you take a liking to like one specific thing.
Yeah.
But there's a word where it's evacerating or vis something where you focus on one thing too much.
Oh, like there's a fancy word for a fascination or infatuation.
Yeah, there's like a legit clinical word that I've heard.
Got it.
I don't remember what
But
it
then
is.
Even though there's all this legit clinical stuff, they boil it down to definitely, maybe, yeah, probably.
Well, that was an online test. That wasn't like a legitimate
clearly,
thing.
Yeah. Everything on the internet is
But anyway,
believed.
So got into teaching.
Yeah.
How did when did you go back to school?
So I had to go back in the state of New Jersey. If you did not graduate from a 4-year institution with a degree in education,
yeah,
you have to go through what's called alternate route certification.
Right.
And it's just literally a room full of second chance people,
yeah,
who just decided, I'm going to be a teacher now because I've seen movies and that's going to work out great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the amount of, this is so sad, the amount of education I got on how to be a teacher was little to none.
Really?
And when I got
Maybe
the job, say again?
Maybe that's a better thing.
It could be, honestly, because one thing I noticed, especially where we work at the high school that we're at, a lot of our alternate route teachers are really good teachers. And I don't know if necessarily that's any, you know, causation and correlation coming together, but I do notice that you bring with yourself something that is a little more worldly, is a little more well-traveled, and maybe not so, let's use the word myopic again, where you didn't have 4 years of here's how a classroom operates and maybe learning in pedagogy, which does have a great value, but I never got that.
What is that?
So, learning in pedagogy. So pedagogy is kind of like the art and science behind teaching and learning.
Okay.
So the way that you direct instruction to students. And
the
by the way—
The formula to teaching.
Yeah, which by the way, that's all I know about pedagogy.
Right.
The definition. That's it.
Oh, it's great.
I got this job. This is so sad that we're all just, it's getting like, get undressed. Here's his job.
Yeah.
I got this job without ever having to do a single demo lesson. Right. I never, ever taught in front of anybody.
Mm.
And I got this job. And it wasn't until the night before my very first day of school that I realized, oh, can I curse on this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. I've listened to episodes. I kind of know that. Oh, shit. I'm going to be in front of 200 kids tomorrow. I have no idea what the fuck I'm doing.
Was that Pequannock?
Yeah. Yeah, I've been Pequannock. That's the only place I've taught.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For the last 9 going on 10 years. And
wow,
it was just
been that long.
Yes.
So that you started at 24?
Technically 23. 23? I turned 24 my
that's
first year
old
of teaching.
I am.
Yeah. And I was teaching. And I was in front of like 18
you started
and some 19-year-olds. I started 07, 08.
Okay.
So that was the time period. And it was just,
08,
again, 09. No education.
I started 08, 09.
Did you really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
08, 09, 09, 010. No, I started 07, 08, right?
So
07, 08, 08, 09,
9, 10, 10, 10,
11. 10, 11. Graduated in 11.
Class of 11, yeah. So I was there for your freshman year.
Wow.
Go figure.
I've been out of high school.
Touched the hammies and never forgot them since. Sounds creepy.
You were that young.
Yes.
I didn't even.
And it's evident. Like, I go back and I look at pictures, and it was just, wow, look at that student in a shirt and tie.
Right, right, right.
It's really bad. That's one of the reasons I grew the beard out. Like, as soon as I grew the beard out, it immediately added, like, another 6-7 years. If I shaved this, I might not look 33.
Right.
Might not. But, yeah, honestly, teaching was just, hey, I'm going to do this now.
So, yeah, but so 20s is usually a time of, like, figuring yourself out. It's kind of kind of elaborating more on what college is as a foundation of trying to find out who you are. And I don't know if that ever fully happens, right? How did being a high school teacher for the majority of your 20s like affect that time period?
Yeah, so let's go back to the family that raised me. The family that raised me to work hard and do a good job at everything.
I wish I...
Which, don't get me wrong, that comes with a lot of detriment and baggage. So this is not meant to be like a wonderful shining accomplishment, but it sets the tone for answering the question. So I'm 23, which, I mean, no one at 23 is supposed to figure anything out at that point.
Right.
Because I feel like that's the job of being an early 20-year-old. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to figure yourself out. But I immediately, as a teacher, realized I want to be a good teacher. And in order to be a good teacher, you have to give up everything of yourself. Mm-hmm. And I did. I gave up everything.
What does that mean?
So it's, and again, maybe other teachers feel differently. So this is what worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
I started seeing my friends a whole hell of a lot less.
Mm-hmm.
Weekends were spent planning lessons and grading papers and thinking of, okay, I went into this thinking that a student would just, you know, be happy with me reading out of a book, doing some practice problems, and yay, learning. No, they need to be entertained. Every day, every class period is a show. And you need to get ready for a 45-minute to hour-long show, and the show changes. Because one period, that show is accounting, and the next period, that show is marketing, because I teach business. So I'm not like a science teacher, where a science teacher like teaches chemistry five times a day. The same show five times.
Yeah.
I teach little different shows throughout the day.
Yeah.
One show is accounting, one show is marketing, one show is law, one show is leadership. And all that preparation was massively time-consuming. The amount of content you have to generate to basically put something on for a room of teenagers that's seamless.
Imagine if every teacher did that.
I can't. You know what? To a certain extent, I'm going to play Pollyanna and wish that I wish that that's how it was, because there wouldn't be sort of like a public backlash. Like teaching is the hardest job that everyone thinks that they can do. And it really, if you want to do it well, for me, meant that you have to, like I said, you have to give your entire self to it. And you have to never falter, never waver. You know, don't let them know you're 23, where basically, you know, they're 18 and 19. They're 4 years removed from where you are. And now you're, hey, I need you to do this. And you should study this. And you need to learn this and that. And if every teacher took that approach, I don't know. I don't know if that works for everybody, because I think what makes a school, now that we're talking about school, sorry, school podcast now, but like every teacher has to be their own person. So like I talked about the whole idea, it's a show, right?
Right.
Like every show needs their own set of characters. Everybody can't be the same.
Yeah.
So you need the boring teacher. You need the fun teacher. You need the cool teacher. You need the one who tries to be everyone's friend. You need the one who's like kind of not really good at their job, but all right, fine. And I love when teachers visit my room. I treat it like a sitcom. Like, character comes through the door, everyone has to clap for him.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Kramer popping through the door, and all of a sudden the entire Seinfeld like set loses their mind.
Yeah, the Commedia dell'arte roles. You got the wild man, you got the yeah, all those different crazy.
And to me, that's what makes it great for everyone. And at 23, I made the determination that that's what I'm going to do. And it turns out, I mean, I'm sorry for being a little egotistical, I was good at it.
Yeah.
But I was also the kind of person that once you put me in something and I know that this works, I'm going to keep doing it because I know it works. And then slowly it just kind of engrossed many parts of my life that at a 20-year-old, you should be spending more time with. You should be going out all the time. You should be showing up to work hungover. You should be, you know, out doing things that are not necessarily that adult-like yet, because you're kind of just removed from college. And I gave a lot of that up. And that's fine. You know, that's okay, because that also then turned me into the person who I am now. So that's like the second stage of the transformation, where now I'm very comfortable doing a great many things, jack of all trades, maybe master of hopefully a couple. And I set that foundation in my early 20s.
Right.
But it also, kind of like I said before, allows me to have a life in my 30s where I'm established in a career. I know how to go out and have fun and have a good time for myself. I'm more worldly and experienced and knowledgeable. And my wife and I both agree, like, our 30s, we love our 30s so much more than our
20s. Wow.
It's not even close.
Everything is a little more set.
Everything's a little more set. You know a little bit more, but you're still young enough to be able to have a good time with yourself.
Wow.
Now, keep in mind, you know, I'm 33 and she's kind of close to my age and we don't have kids yet. So that might change the formula a little bit.
Yeah.
But we still just go out whenever we want to go out, go in the city whenever we want to go in the city. And just we have a better perspective on life because we've lived a decent amount of it. And we've done it, thankfully, knock on wood, successfully. And we're still connected to our youth to a certain degree, where we just have fun, laugh at stupid things, enjoy just silliness. And it's great. If I could have this brain in my 20-year-old body, my 20s have been so much better.
Yeah.
If I could have this brain when I was in college, oh my goodness. College would have to be like a movie script that you couldn't even think
but
to
would
write.
You have been the person you are if you did
no.
that? Exactly.
No.
Yeah, yeah.
No, not at all.
But so you had a very interesting experience in that you were able to kind of oversee, this is kind of a convoluted question, oversee a snapshot, a continuous snapshot of our generation at different times.
Yeah.
Like the kind of the progression of it, right? Like
yes.
You saw the beginning. So I guess like the people who were in high school when you started out, the students, the seniors were the late 1980s, and now it's people when they were born, and now it's people born in the late 1990s. So you've seen a full, like a full 10-year span of our generation. From having that, from being able to oversee that, what do you associate with us in a way of things that you find disconcerting, and then things that you, maybe the opposite things you, if you could even generalize that.
Yeah.
And what did 20-year-old, how did 20-year-olds and people of our generation change you throughout your 10 years of being there?
So let me answer the second part of that first.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be such a cheesy answer.
But yeah.
Honestly, like, I think one of the reasons I have so much fun still is because teenagers are just so hilarious. I take a lot of pride in using teenage colloquialism. I love it. And teenage slang is hilarious to me.
And it always changing. It's always changing.
It's always changing. It's the same concept, but the word changes.
Mm-hmm. What do you got coming? What do you got going now?
Right now, the new hotness, as it were, amongst the kids. So if a teacher, let's say, all of a sudden sees you on your cell phone, you know, give me that cell phone. It's like, oh, Joey just got murked by Mr. Brady.
Murked. I've heard my mom says.
And I ask them, do you know like the origin? Do you know where that word comes from? Because to me, I think mercenary.
Yeah.
Because like, merc was short for mercenary, and mercenaries were like hired hitmen out to go kill, you know, go into that little town in the middle of the jungle and slaughter everybody. Whatever. My favorite one is. By far, this is one of my new favorites. If you chew someone out, right? If you tell someone something insulting or you let them know how terrible they are, you are, quote, giving them the sauce.
Giving them the sauce?
Okay.
They say that now?
Yes, yes. And the first time I heard that was after I basically yelled, not really yelled, but kind of gave a talking to a class for 45 minutes.
Wow.
I was out on medical leave for a long time, and I heard about all the terrible things they did. So my first day back, they thought it was party time, and they realized 30 seconds in, oh no, he's serious.
Right.
So I talked to them for 45 minutes, the whole like, you know, I'm disappointed, you know better, blah, 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 blah. And then a kid comes up to me afterwards. He goes, man, Mr. Brady, you just gave us the sauce, like straight marinara. And I lost my mind. That's hilarious. They started using words like savage.
Yeah, oh, that's a thing.
Savage
that
is so good.
That. I hate
no?
savage.
All right. I understand.
Well, just because people like, I don't know, because they associate it with partying and they're like, that's so savage. Let's be savages tonight. I'm like, I don't want to be.
No,
Well, they do that in college.
Is that what
it has a connotation. Savage is evil. Like, I don't want to get evil because I've seen people who drink too much and actually get evil.
Got it.
It's just like, but I'm a party pooper. I'm no fun, too. So.
Well, listen, it takes one to know one. I totally understand. I felt like the way they used it in high school was just, you know, it was actually used kind of similarly. But it was a bad thing to be a savage. Like, don't be evil. Don't be a savage.
You know that savage is what African Americans were called?
Yeah.
You know, there is savage stemmed from racism.
Yes. Like, godless people in the middle of the jungle with a bone through their nose.
Yes.
Yeah, that kind of thing. No, they don't know that. Yeah. Not in the least. Mm-hmm. Reckless is one of their new ones.
Reckless.
Not a fan.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
It's just not even creative.
Yeah.
Sauced, given the sauce, that's creative to me.
Yeah.
If you're going to go to that step to make it something enjoyable, fine.
Mm-hmm.
Go for it.
So wait, so how has it changed? Because I've heard you say that people, high school students now were different than when I was in high school.
So
what has the transition been in like?
So they're still fun. They're still always fun.
Mm-hmm.
They're always fun. They're always hilarious. And the same social dynamics kind of still exist. You know, your hormones are raging, so you're trying to figure out a little bit about how the interaction with either people of the opposite gender, if that's who you're attracted to, people of the same gender, if that's who you're attracted to, just you're figuring out that idea of attraction. That's still constant.
Yeah,
you know,
that's what's underneath everything.
Absolutely. Oh, God.
Yeah, we
could have a whole nother 3-hour conversation about how biology, I think, drives the entire human race and why men are men and why women are. It's a whole 9 yards.
Yeah.
Stuff like that hasn't changed. The dynamics, the cliques. That kind of hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously the connection to technology is a lot greater than it was.
Mm.
You know, when your cell phone was literally your cell phone and all you could do was kind of text with your friends, fine.
Mm-hmm.
The kids then were still a little bit more openly social for classic social events like homecoming.
Mm-hmm.
Homecoming died a horrible, horrible death.
Did it?
Like in 2011, 2012.
That's when I graduated.
Yeah. No one wanted to go to homecoming.
Why?
I can't prove it, but my guess is you know, the advent of how quickly you could communicate with your friends on your phone and keep it private from your parents and still be able to have that sort of just, ooh, who knows what we're talking about kind of interaction, all of a sudden
they don't want to do it in a public way.
You don't need to do it in a public way anymore. You just don't. And don't get me wrong, there is something to be said for the public interaction and parties, obviously, still. Yeah. But the idea of homecoming was the place to do that, or go to the football game because that was the place to do that. Even that, you know, I've been doing the sidelines at the football games, you know, working the chains, and I've noticed that the student section every year just gets smaller and smaller and smaller.
That's crazy.
Because going out to events or events in general, prom notwithstanding, that doesn't mean much anymore. You know, that's a big difference I've noticed over the years, which is why, like, you know, the school hosts things after school. Mm-hmm. No one goes to them. No one cares. No one wants to show up for stuff. Mm-hmm. And sadly, we still have, like, young teachers still coming out and it's like, oh, we're going to get them to show up to this thing. And, like, good luck with that. That's not going to happen. The one thing, though, that is disconcerting.
Yeah, what do you find discouraging?
Okay. And I know that there's so many cliched things about millennials, and I don't believe them.
Right.
Here's the only two that I latch onto. Number one, the idea of if you want to learn something, just throw it into Google. And I've had this conversation with people my age and just barely younger. If I want to learn something, I don't want to throw it in Google right away. Mm-hmm. I want to find it on my own because I will remember it and it's more meaningful then. Mm-hmm. So I want to, especially like in a social setting when everyone's talking and like, what was the name of the guy in that movie or the girl in that show? And immediately the predilection is go right to the phone. Mm-hmm. No. Let's talk this out for a second because who knows that while we talk this out, something else really enjoyable is going to come up. And all of a sudden, the social interaction blossoms, and that is ultimately more satisfying than getting the answer would ever be.
Right.
And that I feel, and again, I'm not blaming. This isn't one of those get off my lawn, old man moments, but it is just, that's the go-to. Just, you want to know it, okay, put it into Google, and Google's smart enough for even dummies to type in like a half-intelligent question and get an answer to it. And immediately now, it's just there, and there's no
it kind of compromises the sense of discovery.
Yes, discovery. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what maybe it was Neil deGrasse Tyson, who, by the way, I know it's kind of cool to always mention his name. I love Neil deGrasse Tyson. I love him.
Yeah.
And I think he once talked about, like, you know, the idea of in those quiet moments when you kind of could just go right to your phone to just make up for the time that you're sitting in a waiting room. You know, most people who are really good thinkers will just sit and contemplate or absorb the environment around them. And that to them is actually enjoyable. And you have to train your mind to make that something that you want to do.
It's so hard now to sit with nothing.
I know. I just got a, this is so, such an old man comment. I just got a smartphone 2 months ago. It's my first smartphone.
Really?
And even then it's starting to creep in. Yeah. The idea of, well, I can just go on Reddit like right now.
Oh, you are going to,
yeah,
you're going to get completely immersed.
I'm trying to hold out. But he also said, like,
listen to those Louis C.K. things. Oh, just like sitting with nothing is that's what being a person is.
Yes, it really truly is.
Destroying our ability to empathize because
I don't know why I'm going off on this tangent now. There was some cartoon. I remember somebody actually posted it to Reddit, some Cartoon Network cartoon for kids. And it was like a bunch of different characters. And one character's like, let's do something scary. Let's go do a haunted house.
Yeah.
Let's go watch a scary movie. And then one character goes, let's sit in a dark room alone with our thoughts. Like, that is truly scary.
Yeah,
and that's lost on a lot of younger people. But here's the big one. And I know this has been a long-winded answer. The privacy issue.
Right.
That it's socially acceptable to take pictures and videos of people, whether they know it or not. And it's the or not part that gets me.
Yeah.
And that bothers me.
Can you imagine what politics is going to be like 30 years from now? People running, they're going to have a whole technological history that people can just like look into. It'd be like, like snap vid stories coming up at a surface of like a presidential candidate when he was like 25 or something.
I'm going to be honest. I don't know what a vid story is. I know what Snapchat is.
You can make a story
that
instead of sending one directly, a Snapchat of a video or something you see, there's a thing where kind of like Twitter where it's like everyone that you follow, it's a continuous
like a feed.
Story. So like I could be videoing right now and then put it in the story and then people could see that as a part of my story. Everyone who follows me as opposed to someone I just send it to directly.
Okay, because so it's a little more perpetual.
Yes.
Than just being instant and gone.
And it's for anyone who follows you, as okay. opposed to if I just wanted to send this to like one person.
See, that is kind of interesting, and I would imagine you could do some really creative
story
stuff with
snap
that.
Snap vid is the ultimate way. That whole thing you're talking yeah. about of not needing to be at a public place to connect, it's because everyone knows what everyone's doing because of snap vid.
Right.
No one's living their life. I don't really snap story that much. I've been starting to. My camera's also broken. So
I mean, it's the same thing why a lot of like musicians just hate the fact that everyone now experiences a concert through the
lens.
That's
comedians too.
Really?
Well, comedians don't like it because they can't go to a comedy club to test out their material right. without someone filming it.
Right.
A lot of people do. They just do the phones at the bucket at the beginning of the thing. They have sure. like, they have like the X-ray things or.
See, I gotta be honest, I haven't noticed that. Yeah. I like to go to Bananas in Hasbrook Heights when like yeah. a lot of comedians come around that I've
right,
always
right.
enjoyed.
I've heard of Bananas.
But oh my God, it's the worst. It's a Holiday Inn
yeah.
with a conference room.
I've heard that.
It's yeah. so terrible, but yeah. you have to go and see just how horrible and awful yeah. it is. I've never seen anyone do that there.
Mm-hmm.
But typically the Bananas crowd is also an older crowd, so
right,
that
right.
might have a lot to do with it as well.
Right.
But to do that at a comedy show?
A lot of the bigger comedians do it when they're trying to test out stuff because they know that they're going to get filmed because right. they're the bigger ones.
But why? I guess maybe that's another thing I don't connect with. Why do you want to... a concert, I get. You want to film a concert. It's a memory of something very unique. Right. Sure, fine. I don't do it. I take a couple pictures at a concert. I might record like a snippet of a song and I'll hold the camera.
Right.
Or because I used to bring my digital
and then,
camera.
Yeah, these people are the ones that they're compromising their actual eyesight.
Yeah.
They're not like, watching it. They're watching it through in real time what they're recording.
Right. Remove that device that's 2 feet in front of your face.
Yeah.
Just lower it slightly and the real thing is happening in front of you.
That's like Louis C.K. He's got a joke about how parents like filmed parties of kids with iPads and they're watching it through. They're like, sure, the resolution on the iPad's great, but the resolution on the kid
yes.
is good too. Use your real eyes to experience what's happening. But so, on an intellectual level, discouraging and encouraging about people are around my age and younger.
Okay, so I think discouraging I kind of already got out of the way. The idea
yeah.
of, you know, discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Discovery is so
mm-hmm.
amazing, and I love discovery.
Mm-hmm.
So let's put that aside.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you guys have so much information and you're good at using it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of information that you guys just totally, you guys, that group kind of just
you're
throws
a millennial
out.
Too,
I know, that's why I just caught
associate.
Myself. It took me like saying it twice to realize you're
the
talking about
the mold,
you.
The normal mold. But
no,
you're
just
here.
Because there's gray in your beard doesn't mean you too aren't one of them.
Yeah. You're on the show for a reason. <Mr.
Brady>. This isn't That Millennial Life with special guest, a non-millennial.
Yeah.
We found one.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't work that way. The idea of you, there's a lot of information available, and sure, some of it is just readily tossed out,
mm-hmm.
but the vast majority of it is utilized
mm-hmm.
in a great way.
I hope
because,
so.
Because I see it even with the teenagers. Like, the smart kids are smarter. The athletes are more athletic.
Mm-hmm.
The artists are more artistic because anything they ever needed to know to make whatever they love better about themselves, it's available. And since they're in that kind of formative years, they just get better
seeping
quicker.
In sooner, yeah.
yeah, they get better quicker at it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have a longer time to perfect the thing that they love. And then it turns into just a better, for lack of a better term, better crafted individual
right.
at that particular aspect of their life.
Yeah.
And we didn't have that. Like I was saying, like, we wanted to learn about something, you go to the library, and if you got to go to the library as a teenager, you're not going to make that effort because you're still
mm-hmm.
a teenager. But the fact that I can get that information right away, all of a sudden my teenage tendency to not want to do a lot of work
mm-hmm.
doesn't come into play anymore. The information's there, and now
mm-hmm.
I have it, and I'm going to do something with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys are good at that. The tolerance is so much better.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone
yeah.
is so much more accepting of what used to be the stigmatized, whether it's different races, different cultures, different sexual orientations,
mm-hmm.
things like that. And I don't know if this is true amongst a lot of younger people, but I feel like things like religion
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden
just don't,
work anymore.
Yeah.
Doesn't work anymore, man.
Yeah.
Because anything that maybe was supposed to be kept on a faith basis, mm-hmm. all of a sudden now gets shaken to its foundation when you learn about what else is out there, whether it's another religion or just the way the world works.
And I think we also have grown up in a time where we could see where we were firsthand, in our formative years, saw firsthand the negative aspects of what religion can do.
Mm-hmm.
There's people killing in the name yeah. of religion. There's
I was hardcore sick. Catholic.
Yeah.
Like Jim Gaffigan has a line about his wife. He's like, my wife is like Shiite Catholic. Mm-hmm. That was me. Like I knew, yeah, that's a great Gaffigan line. Yeah. And I knew.
His wife wrote that? His wife helps write his yeah. stand-up.
Well, his previous wife, because I thought they divorced. Wife.
Oh, did they? I don't.
Is he on his second wife? I thought he was on his second wife, and this was like first wife.
Jeannie?
I don't know.
But anyway.
All I know is that I love Jim Gaffigan and that little inner monologue he does. Oh. It's just, when he evolved to that part of his stand-up.
Why is he talking like that?
Yeah. So I was hardcore Catholic.
Right.
And then, I mean, this could be a whole nother conversation. I went to a Catholic university
mm-hmm.
and I would always go to mass like every Sunday. Mm-hmm. And during Lent, you know, not going to eat meat, abstinent on Friday, mm-hmm. go to mass on Fridays as well. And then I would go on retreats and I was part of the campus ministry. And then my religious foundation was shaken to the core because one of the priests on campus that I look up to mm-hmm. like a lot, all of a sudden gets wrapped up in a sex scandal mm-hmm. with a young man, and he claims that he had a condition called sleep sex. This was like, I'm sleepwalking, and in my sleepwalking state, I sexually abuse particularly this young person.
That is ridiculous.
And then as soon as that, got it. There's no segue after that now.
Yeah. You just said I, so I want people to make sure that you wasn't...
And after that, like, it shook my entire foundation of the core.
Right.
And interesting enough, like, all those things that you could go on the internet now as a young kid, like, you're curious about the universe
right.
and think about, I used to think about those things in church.
Right.
Like, I used to think about infinity in church,
right.
and the universe in church, and what does it really mean to go to heaven?
Right.
And am I going to feel and sense things in heaven? Like, I feel and sense, like, that, you just go online, go on Reddit and go on Our Atheism, you know, you get that answer in the FAQs, you know, that's there. And I discovered that in church.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it took me a longer time to get to my religious agnosticism, because mm-hmm. that's kind of where I'm at right
Same.
Now, where it's just,
usually,
you know,
don't even think about it.
I don't. I never do.
I'm a spiritual person in that I think of, like, what does this all mean? Is there
sure.
a reason?
Sure.
But I don't think, like,
maybe karma if you want to go crazy, which I'm a believer in. Just do good things, be a good person,
yeah.
just live your life and treat others well.
And when you talk about that idea of tolerance, it's interesting because one of my most recent interviews, I had a conversation where tolerance was the main topic, because there was a girl from my college who I think fit the mold of someone in my generation of who I disagree with, that sometimes on social media can express their intolerance with people who are intolerant.
Right. So they found a place where their voice
mm-hmm.
is absolutely heard, understood, and agreed with.
Right. And it's not necessarily that I disagree with the idea of doing that, more so the manner in which
it's done.
Sometimes,
or at least espoused.
Yeah. Sometimes they become the bully themselves.
Sure.
They disregard that someone may be of that ilk. Why are they like that? I may disagree with you. I understand that you're like this, could because of this, acknowledging the other side.
Yeah.
But which I said in a previous podcast, I think, you know, not acknowledging any other side of what you may believe could be summed up to the reason as to why there's any problem.
I agree. I could not agree more.
Yeah.
That idea of just everyone has their own, the one thing that links all of us is that we are all human and we all experience this human struggle in some way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
And however you want to live your life and I live my life,
mm-hmm.
and so long as you don't have to necessarily interfere with mine that much, mm-hmm. it's okay to understand where we come from and that we're different and you think this way and I think that mm-hmm. way. And I mean, if you really want to look at the universe from a fatalistic sort of perspective, like, there is no such thing as right. There is no such thing as wrong. It's just a societal construct.
Me and Stav are getting into a lot of philosophy stuff.
Yeah. I used to
hate
philosophy.
There's this podcast called Philosophize This. It's great.
Yeah?
Because that's all that is. We're learning about belief and right, good and evil, right or wrong, tolerance. That thing I just talked about is called, like, the paradox of tolerance.
Okay.
And how, like, to what degree should we be tolerant of other people's views that we view as intolerant? So we're in all that. We're trying to
plug that one more time.
Philosophize this.
Okay.
Great.
Okay.
Stav is way more in deep than I am, because I'm trying to plow through all of WTF.
Oh,
with
sure.
Mark Maron.
Well, I mean, Mark Maron's tremendous, but.
But anyway, I wanted to ask just if you, what advice do you have for any people in their 20s? And also, you said you wanted to give any financial advice for people in their 20s. And I find that really interesting because through my research about different things associated with millennials, something that I see a lot is that one thing that's associated with us in terms of finance is that we're a generation that is saving a lot more.
Yeah.
Because our formative years were during during the Great Recession.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're kind of weary of the system. We have a distrust in the system.
And you should.
Yeah.
I'm going to be honest. You should.
And there's a lot of people who, I've seen a lot of stuff about millennials who aren't necessarily beginning to invest because of that, maybe when they should. And a lot of my friends are starting to talk about that and 401ks and all that stuff. And I really have no idea. And I'm sure a lot of young people don't as well. So.
Yeah. So what I've found, on the side, I'm licensed for a lot of different financial services on the side. And I do it as more or less not to make a lot of money, but the people I work with exclusively, they fall into two groups. Mm-hmm. Either I work with teachers, because again, I am one. I know the struggles we go through. Mm-hmm. And the last person a teacher takes care of is typically themselves. So mm-hmm. I'm really happy to work with teachers on something that most of them don't know much about. Mm-hmm. And then I also work with a lot of young people. And one thing I notice is that the younger people I work with badly want to learn more about personal finance, mm-hmm. but it's tough to make sense of because, again, there's this aversion to the system, which mm-hmm. I cannot blame anybody for because mm-hmm. we are now only barely pulling ourselves out of it. Mm-hmm. And most of the people who were responsible for it are not at all being punished in any way, shape, or form. But that's
which we learned from The Big Short.
Oh, well, seriously, please go see The Big Short. Everybody should see that movie.
Multiple times. Yes. I got it on Blu-ray right there.
I can confirm I see the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
It's a great movie that explains a lot about what happened.
Collateralized debt obligation.
Yeah. Did you know what that was before you went in?
No.
You know what's sad? I knew exactly what it was, and he described it perfectly.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that to brag. It was just good on you, Adam McKay, because I watched Step Brothers. I did not think you had this level of intellect.
He's a big, not politics, because I've actually heard him say I don't talk about politics, because politics is backdoor schemes and stuff. He talks about policy.
Sure.
But anyway.
And he did a great job with that film. So really, mm-hmm. every young person, here we go. Start there. Watch that movie. Mm-hmm. You'll be entertained. It's hilarious. And you learn a lot from it. Mm-hmm. But I noticed that a lot of young people want to learn more about finance and how to take the appropriate steps. But there's so much conflicting information. And honestly, the system is designed, and it's such like a, you know, terrible thing to describe as just the system. Mm-hmm. But it is. It's designed so that finance is just money transfer. That's it. It goes from you to somebody else, from somebody else to you. I'm a firm believer that a lot of finance is a zero-sum game. If you gain, someone somewhere has to lose.
Right.
So what you need to do in order to make sure that your financial life is stable is to make sure that you are informed and you make safe, appropriate decisions from an early age. Mm-hmm. Like I started my retirement account, the one that I still have today, and it's one of three. I maintain three separate ones. I started it when I was 19.
Wow.
Because the idea of saving now and compounding makes a bigger difference if you can do it for a longer time. And at 19, I even felt like, oh shit, I should have started when I was 18 when I could actually open an account. And I felt like I was a year too late.
Oh, that's great.
So to me, like if you're in your early 20s, like you and you want to get into this, mm-hmm. you know, find someone who can walk you through a little bit of it mm-hmm. because now is the time to do it. Like I sadly work with a lot of older people as well that they come to me and like, oh, I don't have any money in my 401k. Like, okay, and what's going on? How old are you? I'm 63.
Oh, no.
Oh, you need to go get a job at Walmart now if they're still hiring greeters because there's no recovering from that. And I think if you know a little bit and you have someone who's willing to help you out and work with you and partner with you, I mean, finance, it's very doable.
Right.
It's very easy. You just got to kind of understand and have a plan.
Right.
And if that kind of works out, young people, there's so many awesome technological tools now for mm-hmm. finance that once you know what you want to do, there's a tool out there to help you accomplish it mm-hmm. and to do it so that you honestly don't have to think about it that much. And there's a way to matriculate and make your way through all these confusing terms, the 401ks and the IRAs and stuff like that.
So the savings good.
Yeah. Investing. Savings great. Investing's got to be done the right way.
Right.
You know, a lot of people are stock analysts. Got it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've read a lot of books on investing, And investing and picking stocks are two different things. Picking right. stocks is gambling, and investing requires homework and a disciplined method behind it. And, you know, one of the things that I read was New York Times back in the 80s looked at a bunch of people who ran what are called mutual funds. And mutual funds are like a big collection of money.
Right.
Kind of like actually you saw in The Big Short.
Right.
Like Steve Carell's outfit, where you give them a bunch of money and they invest that money on behalf of the people who it originated from.
Mm-hmm.
And they return the profits. And they tracked these mutual fund managers for years, their performance, basically their stock picks, you know, much like you might have a guy on ESPN tracking his football picks kind of thing. And like by the time you were 6, 7, 8 months in, 1, 2, 3 years in, a lot of them, they didn't even want their stuff published and picked anymore because they failed. And there's nobody who can definitively say, I'm going to outperform the market is a typical phrase.
Like, right.
I'm going to do better than anybody else. You can't. You can't. You know, if you're a believer in economics, then the stock market and investing is what's called an efficient market, which means by the time you buy a stock, whether you think that stock's going to go up or not, any information that you utilize to make that decision, somebody somewhere else already had and already acted upon.
Right.
And you're way too late. And if
there's no first to the game.
There's no first to the game anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So the safest thing to do is to come up with a better plan and do it just from a broader perspective. And there's ways to do that. And it's a little more intelligent. And don't get me wrong, so maybe you don't make as much money. But if you're into this to make money, then you're not doing personal finance. You're just looking to invest and get rich. And I don't think that's what a lot of young people want to do.
Yeah.
I think, honestly, they just know that I have to get a retirement account.
Mm-hmm.
I have to manage my money. I got to pay a mortgage, which is also something I don't believe, but we'll talk about that another time. And they just don't know how to get started.
Right.
You know, I feel like a lot of younger people, once you show them, they're okay.
Mm-hmm.
They just need a little helping hand in order to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine.
And we have the ability to, like you said, find that stuff out easily.
Oh, yeah.
And if I ever need help, I'll just use you. You know?
Sure. That's what I'm here for. Mm-hmm. And I help a lot of different people from a lot of different ways. And I'm happy to do it because, again, I was fortunate. You know, a lot of the teachers I talk to, one of the things that one of my great teacher friends says is, like, everybody has their own strengths.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay to not be great at everything.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that, like, from an early age made sense to me was finance and money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm clearly not rich. Again, third time probably saying this, public employee, and I'm not starving. You know,
mm-hmm.
I live in a decent house. I have a decent life. I do a lot of fun things, and I spend money, and I can also save 3 different retirement mm-hmm. accounts and have enough to buy another house maybe in another couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you do it the right way, and I was lucky to be able to do it the right way from an early age, you make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't do it, that's fine. Find somebody who'll help you out.
Yeah. Well, as someone who's been through their 20s, we got to wrap up soon here.
This has been great, by the way. Thank you so much.
It's been awesome. It's been definitely one of the funner conversations I've had.
Yeah, I have no idea what time it is right now.
It's 8:30.
Wow.
We've been going for about an hour and a half.
This is great.
Yeah.
And my wife has probably enjoyed every bit of this because I am not home right now.
Well, so I want to get to that quick.
Okay.
But just, do you have any more, a quick, broader...
Oh, like piece of advice you asked about. Yeah. All right. Read.
Mm-hmm.
Just read books.
Podcasts are good.
And podcasts are great too.
Mm-hmm.
We listen to a lot of podcasts as well. Oh, okay. Can I give you, let me retract. Ready?
Yeah.
NPR.
Oh my God.
Young people, okay, whatever stigma that NPR might have attached to it, get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to as much NPR as you possibly can.
Old people listen to it.
Yeah.
I listen to it. To me, it's the most reliable American news source.
Correct.
It's the most centrist, even though they are a little left-leaning.
A little left-leaning, yes.
But they are what the 24-hour news cycle should be
through
the radio.
And NPR, a lot hipper than people think.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so I love
Fresh Air is so good.
Yes,
Terry Gross.
Yes. News, politics, sports.
Yeah. Money, NPR
comedy, money, Market Watch.
Mm-hmm.
Market Watch, like, you can listen to it on the East Coast here on WQXR.
So just learn is what you're saying.
Just learn. And NPR is a great way to do it because...
Don't get stuck in your echo chamber of online videos and just, like, your break out from what you normally want.
Yeah.
I'm one of those people because I keep listening to what to WTF podcast because it's entertainment. It's what I love. But I want to listen to Philosophize This. I want to listen to NPR Money. I want to broaden... and kind of start to learn things that I don't usually associate with what my favorite things are.
Right. Think your own thoughts and don't judge anybody else for theirs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously stand up for yourself. And if anybody's infringing upon you in a way that's just, okay, not cool, sure, stand up and say something. But the idea of, like we talked about tolerance, you know, learn about how everybody else thinks and form your opinion based off of that.
Right.
You know, and find your own kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really is something great to do in your early 20s.
Yes, I agree. So we usually end with hopes for the future.
Yeah.
You just got married.
Yeah, I did. 2 years now. Which, by the way, we're busting another legend right now because I've convinced the last 6 years of students that my wife is not real. That she's an actress that I hired in order to show up at family events, like a paid public appearance, and that we just rented a tux and a dress and took professional photographs. Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe not that kind of escort, but fine. Yeah. You know what we're talking about. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. High class.
Oh, clear, like a Julia Roberts type? Sure. And hopes for the future, we're at that point where kids, definitely.
Wow.
And it's late, I think, for us, for kids. Like my dad.
Please.
I know.
Not for now.
I know.
People having kids in their 40s.
Yeah. My wife feels like, you know, I can't believe I'm using another old movie reference. I just did Julia Roberts. My wife is kind of like Marissa Tomei in My Cousin Vinny. You know, my biological clock is ticking. And then she feels that way. And
bam.
Yeah. It's another great movie people need to see.
Oh, my God.
And
two Utes.
What?
Yeah.
Now we're just doing My Cousin Vinny.
Yeah.
Which we could totally be fine with.
Joe Pesci's.
And my dad was 33, I think, when he had me.
Oh.
And I just feel the pressure for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we talked about biology before. Something changed in me. I hated kids. Like, don't get me wrong, I work with teenagers. I like teenagers, but I hated little
boring.
Kids. They're just boring and
they're
noisy.
They're just dumb
and
people.
They really are. What comedian described them as drunk elderly people?
Right. Oh, God.
That's what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And now I see little children, and I just go, oh my God, I want one.
Oh, no, that's great.
And I just want to. Okay, so here's another thing that just makes me so soft. I love Arcade Fire. I don't care what that makes me sound like.
I love Arcade Fire.
I love Arcade Fire. The first Arcade Fire album I listened to was The Suburbs when it came out.
That one album of the year.
Yes. And when, by the way,
people are like, who are Arcade Fire?
Okay, quickly, one of my favorite t-shirts I own is a t-shirt that says, who the fuck is Arcade Fire?
Yeah.
Because that was every Twitter post after they won album of the year. So the Wynn Butler and Regine wrote that album basically where I'm at in my life in their early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole album is about looking back on your youth and how are things different now when you're older and just to see that matriculation. And everything that they said was going to happen is happening. And I can't deal with that.
What's that? What's
just the idea of just aging and the world changes. And there's a line in one of the songs, and it's going to kill me. I don't remember the song. And he's like, I pray to God I have a daughter so I can show my daughter all the wonderful things about the world. And if I can't have that, maybe I'll have a son. And there's something there that now I absolutely connect with. And that is like the focus of my life now. Now we have to have children because I want to bring another life into this world that I know is going to appreciate what we have and raise a child the way that I know is going to just make a better, it's addition by addition. You know, let's improve our society with another amazing person. And I don't want that to sound egotistical, but just because now all of a sudden my mind has switched on to child rearing, this is what we're doing now. And we're going to be goddamn great at it. And my child is going to listen to NPR. My child's going to read books. Like, I see you have Game of Thrones up there. Like, I will, my child should read Game of Thrones by age 9. I'm fine with that.
I've only read the first Game of Thrones.
Okay.
Got to read them all.
Yeah.
I want
to read
them after the series.
You have to read
them. I don't want to do this back and forth.
I stopped watching the series because of things that are changing. And I want to read the books first. But things like, you know, everything that was taboo when I was a kid. Like, don't talk to your kids about sex. I want my son or daughter by age 10 to know how it works. And to know that, listen, you're gonna start liking other people.
You're gonna have some bad sexual experience.
Sure. It's gonna be awkward. Yeah, exactly. You're gonna fumble through it.
Yeah.
You know, just turn your cell phone off because you don't want to see your sex face kind of thing. Just you have to know it so that it doesn't become this mystical thing. Because we're removing ourselves from that mystical world, you know, day by day. Nothing is
nothing is in this ethereal void anymore.
Mm.
Everything needs to be out in the open, and that has to be okay.
Yeah.
And then you decide what you want to do with that, but at least you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I want my children to know that. Not right away,
mm-hmm.
like at age 3.
Yeah. Like,
we're going to watch The Shining.
Yeah. Is that blood coming from the walls?
Yeah, correct.
Dad,
what is that dog
watching...
doing to that butler?
Yeah.
All right, I'll tell you when you're 10.
Yeah. Maybe not South Park right away.
Yes. Oh, the greatest satire of the last 20 years.
Oh, my God. I love that you said this, that. And this has been a delight, Mr. Brady.
Likewise. Pleasure's on this side of the table. Yeah.
That feels weird.
Again,
still.
Band-Aid was ripped off. Now you just rip open the wound again.
Mm-hmm.
Pour a little salt in it and we'll be fine.
Yeah. Well, I very much appreciate you coming on and providing a different perspective, a much
that.
More different perspective than any other previous guest.
Thank you.
And I hope you all the continuous success in your life.
Likewise.
All right.
You're going to be fine.
Cool.
Thanks, Joe.
Okay, that is it. That is the conversation I had with Mr. Brady. That was, you know, that was one of those conversations where it was hour and a half, didn't even realize. Hour 40 minutes, didn't even realize. So I'm sorry if that was a little long for you guys, but we had some catching up to do, and I thoroughly enjoyed talking to someone of that age and getting that different dynamic. So thank you, Mr. Brady, for providing your voice and a unique perspective. Thank you to everyone who's listened. Please rate, review on iTunes, subscribe if you have not. Like I said before, I'll be back again next week with another episode, hopefully. I'm going to try to start contacting some guests who may have a little more of public prominence to try to get this show into some different people's ears. So maybe hopefully look out for that. But yeah, thanks to everyone. I'm going to go, you know, try to celebrate my 23rd birthday. Have a good week, everybody. Enjoy.